This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Welcome back to the PFC podcast. The views and opinions you are about to hear are the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of anyone else. Now on to the podcast.
Welcome back to the PFC podcast. Today I am with Ian and we are going over hot weather injuries since we are well into July. I think it's a pretty timely topic. How's things going with you, Ian?
Good. You know, I'm stuck in the COVID Groundhog Day a lot of the time here, but things are finally starting to open back up a little bit and finally starting to get back out and do some teaching and instruction.
Yeah, outstanding.
But thanks for having me back on. And we talk about heat injuries and illness today.
Yeah, that sounds great.
So we're gonna go over kind of the whole scope from the minor heat problems to the more severe, and then certainly the life-threatening heat stroke. We'll talk a little bit about the background of it, and particularly the treatment of it. There's not actually any prolonged field care guidelines for heat stroke. The one reference I'd recommend for folks is the Wilderness Medical Society practice guidelines for prevention and treatment of heat-related illness. That gives a good science-based overview of all these conditions and the best approach to it. And I'll probably hit a couple of their high points as we go through this. The first thing we got to talk about, though, is we got to do a couple quick seconds of background science on body heat and how we gain and lose heat, just because these are the ways that we're going to be using to prevent people from getting too hot, and certainly for trying to cool them. And that's going to be our radiation, conduction, convection, and evaporation. And just to remind everyone that is, so radiation is the direct transfer of heat, electromagnetic transfer of heat between objects. And in particular for us, this is relevant when you're talking about standing out in the sunlight, right? This is how you pick up the heat from the sun. And this is actually why when you're out in the sun, you want to have some sort of covering on. And that's why when you're wearing your combat uniform, you actually have your sleeves down when you're standing in the sun to reduce that radiative heat. But then when we're cooling people down to get them into the shade, we want to get those clothing off of them, because that exposed skin will then lose some heat through radiation. Conduction is the transfer of heat between surfaces. So this is when we're laying somebody down on a cold surface to lose heat. Convection is the movement of a fluid over the body causing the loss of heat. So that's, in a sense, that's either air or water. And when we're, particularly when we're cooling somebody down for heat stroke, we're going to use several of these methods. And then finally, there's evaporation. And key thing about evaporation is when we're in hot environments, basically if you have a temperature over 95 degrees, that's really the only good technique we have for the body to try and control its excessive heat is through evaporation. And as all of us spend all the time, or used to spend all the time down in the southeast of the U.S. where it's over 95 essentially all the time, that's the most important mechanism we have for losing heat. So those are the basics, and we'll come back to those when we're talking about how to treat all these heat injuries. Now, the basic problem, of course, with all heat injuries is that you built up too much heat for your body to dissipate it, and that causes the problem. So when we talk about a response to heat, the body is doing the things it can to dump heat. And this is going to be the skin vasodilating. So you're moving heat to the skin so you can dump it off in the atmosphere for all those things we just talked about, as well as increasing your cardiac output so you can pump more blood to the skin so that you can lose that heat by transferring it quickly to the skin. And when we talk about heat stroke, we'll talk about the things that are risk factors for it. And basically, you can think of anything that's going to affect those things, your ability to move blood to the skin, your ability to vasodilate, and then certainly anything that affects your ability to sweat are all going to increase your risk of heat injury. So we'll start off with a quick mention of hydration. Obviously, to maintain cardiac output, you have to stay hydrated. And hopefully this is a refresher for everybody, but you want to maintain hydration when you're in a hot environment. And what do you use to determine that? Well, it turns out that thirst is not a very good method of determining whether you're dehydrated or not. By the time you're thirsty, typically you're already down 1 to 1.5 liters. And when you're talking about rehydrating somebody, there is a maximum amount of fluid you can take in orally, and that's actually only about 1 liter per hour. So if somebody's already down a couple of liters by the time they're feeling thirsty, it's gonna require some time to make up for that. So the best thing is probably everybody's familiar with is what is your urine look like? You know, we want something that's kind of down near the look of a very light beer, so just a slight tinge of yellow in it. We don't want anything that's looking like a pale ale, and certainly not an IPA or a stout. So I like using the beer analogy because I think most people have seen what beer looks like. Now, this assumes that you're not taking medications that are going to change the color of your urine, and that you're not taking vitamins that are going to change the color of your urine. But otherwise, that's going to be one of the best assessments of your overall hydration status. And then certainly when we're talking about exercise or exertional activities in a hot environment, weight change is going to be a very good indicator of your hydration status. And that's actually what's used for a lot of ultra endurance athletic events is pre and post exercise weights, because they're going to give you a pretty exact idea of how much fluid that you lost. Okay, so now we can start moving into some of the issues that we get with heat. The first is heat cramps. And I think probably a few people have experienced this, these really painful muscle spasms, typically unilateral, but can be bilateral. And the calves are some of the most commonly affected. Now, I can tell you that we don't know exactly what causes these, to be honest. The original idea was that these were caused by kind of a relative hyponatremia or electrolyte imbalance within the muscle itself. Now there's a lot of idea that it's actually focal excitation and intracellular calcium release within the muscle bodies themselves. So you don't really know exactly what causes it. The good news is that the treatment, regardless of that cause, tends to be pretty much the same. And that's going to be a replacement with some sort of hydrating fluid that has salt in it. So adding a little bit of salt to water, and certainly for most of us, that's going to be using a watered-down sports drink, a half-and-half sports drink. And one of the reasons that people originally said, oh, yes, it's got to be electrolytes, is you'll see a lot of people actually use pickle juice to treat this in sports venues. And it turns out that works very well. So some sort of oral replacement with a salt-type solution. Now, in really severe cases, if you give somebody IV saline, they actually do recover very quickly. But we don't want to be doing that in a limited resource environment or a prolonged field care environment. Next up is heat syncope. And I'll tell you, one thing about heat injuries is almost all of them are preventable. Not 100%, but most of them are preventable, particularly when you allow people to acclimatize to heat, which as human beings we can do, and I'll cover that a little bit later on. So heat syncope is basically the person that is not acclimatized to heat and is a little bit dehydrated, maybe gets a little bit hypothermic, and is standing. So this is your new military recruit or your newer person that's from a cold environment that goes to a hot environment, and they're standing at the range, and they just suddenly collapse. And heat syncope is really due to a relative volume depletion. You're peripherally vasodilated because you're warm and you're trying to dump that heat, and your body just doesn't quite respond by constricting your blood vessels quick enough for you to not have that passing out of that syncope. Now, the treatment for it is you're just going to lie the person flat, you're going to move them out of the direct heat, and you're going to orally rehydrate them. So how do we separate out heat syncope from heat stroke? Well, with heat syncope, once somebody goes down, they're going to recover very quickly. Because once they're down, they're going to start perfusing again, and they're not going to have an altered mental status, which is a key to heat stroke we'll talk about later on. So heat syncope, you know, again, it's somebody that's really not acclimatized, you're used to see bad syncope, and they recover very quickly when you lie them down and move them out of the heat. If they don't recover quickly or they've got altered mental status, then they got to start thinking that actually this is a more severe form of heat illness. The next is going to be heat exhaustion. So heat exhaustion is what probably a lot of us have experienced to some small extent. And basically, this is the start of the continuum that will lead to heat stroke. So signs of heat exhaustion should be a warning sign to us that we need to do something to make sure individuals don't develop heat stroke. And this is where you work in an environment, you start feeling a little bit weak, start feeling a little bit lightheaded, start feeling fatigued, you lose your appetite, you have some nausea. You may, as it gets more severe, have an episode of vomiting. You get a headache, and you really kind of get that more pronounced thirst. And you've already said that by the time you get thirsty, we know you're markedly dehydrated. A little bit tachycardic, a little bit tachypneic. You're going to be sweating a lot, but you have a normal mental status. So with heat exhaustion, you're getting all these symptoms, but your mental status is normal. And typically, your core body temperature is not going to be that high either. Now, again, the treatment, so for heat exhaustion, the treatment is going to be getting you out of the heat, getting out of what's exposing you to the problem. So get somebody into the shade, get their clothing off, any restrictive clothing, and start hydrating them up. Now, again, remember, we can't really hydrate anybody up more than about a liter an hour. So we want to give them a couple liters over 2 to 4 hours. You just really can't absorb more than about a liter an hour. Anything beyond that starts making either hyponatremic or giving you diarrhea or both, depending on what you're rehydrating somebody with. And again, somebody with heat exhaustion has a normal mental status. If somebody's got an altered mental status and heat exhaustion, then really they're developing heat stroke. So mental status is a key thing that we're looking for in these individuals. So progression from heat exhaustion. So if somebody's getting heat exhaustion and we don't take care of them, then they can move on to heat stroke. And heat stroke is now the point where you've got so much heat on board that your body can't deal with it, and it actually sets off an inflammatory condition, sort of like a SIRS condition, severe inflammatory syndrome. And there are a bunch of things that are risk factors for it. Now, with the military, usually we're talking about healthy individuals, so that's not as much of an issue. But with other individuals, there are a bunch of risk factors for it. And first, I want to break down there's two forms of heat stroke we talk about. There's classic heat stroke and exertional heat stroke. So classic heat stroke is what most people are taught in their medical courses, which is where somebody has a ultra-male status, they're not sweating at all, and they have a core body temperature 105 or higher, at least 104 and higher. Classic heat stroke is what we see with old or sick individuals. These are your geriatrics that are stuck at home with a bunch of medical conditions. In the military, what you're going to see is you're going to see exertional heat stroke. These are going to be young, healthy people without really medical problems, and they're sweating profusely, but they're markedly altered and have an elevated core temperature. So I think it's important to get rid of some of the preconcepts that people may have been taught, that for heat stroke, you're not going to be sweating at all. In fact, what most people listening to this are going to see is they're going to see exertional heat stroke, where people are going to be sweating profusely. Now, with certainly with classic heat stroke, you know, anything that prevents sweating, anything that prevents cardiac output from going up, anything that prevents vasodilation and dumping of heat through the skin is going to increase your risk factor. So that's going to be heart disease, skin diseases, dehydration, fever, drugs that prevent all that. So beta blockers, antihistamines. Antihistamines prevent you from sweating. Like, people are probably not aware that just taking Benadryl can decrease your ability to sweat, so slightly increase your risk of a heat injury. Certainly diuretics. So again, you can see all these things are what we see in elderly or geriatric populations, and that's why they get the classic heat stroke. So again, with the military population, we're going to be looking at exertional heat stroke, where they're doing some sort of exertion in the hot environments, sweating profusely, but go down and have an elevated core temperature and an altered male status. So heat stroke is a true medical emergency. And our goal with heat stroke is to get their temperature down as quickly as possible. Now, as opposed to hypothermia, when we talk about that, right? The amount of time it takes you to warm somebody up is really not that critical. With heat stroke, time is critical. So the longer they have an elevated temperature, the more inflammatory response they're going to have. Essentially, just think the more brain matter they're going to cook. So with heat stroke, you got to get somebody's temperature down as quickly as we can. And what are you going to see? So again, it's going to be somebody that's altered. First thing you see is ataxia. So if you get somebody out exerting, rocking, and all of a sudden they're becoming ataxic and altered, they're developing heat stroke. Those of you that are taking care of heat stroke, you probably noticed that most of the patients tend to be confused, combative, irritable. They're definitely altered. You can have seizures, a little rarer, but again, ataxia is the first thing, then just altered and combative are the next most common things that I think most of us have seen. But any CNS binding can be seen with heat stroke. So once you've seen that, we need to treat them and treat them quickly. Now, a note on temperature. So we need a core temperature is what we're looking for. And sort of the gold standard is the rectal temperature, because that's the easiest to get. I mean, a true gold standard is going to be an esophageal temperature or something like that, but you're just not going to get that in the field. So we're looking for core temperature, and if we can get it, a rectal temperature is going to be your gold standard for that. And what our goal is definitely get the temperature below 104 as rapidly as possible, but then we're going to keep cooling them down to about 102 degrees. Now, if you look across the literature, I was just looking at this over the last week, and I've seen recommendations anywhere from get their temperature down to 100 degrees, to get it down to 101, to get it down to 102. I can tell you sort of the gold standard right now, the WS recommendations, is you want to get their core temperature down to about 39 degrees centigrade or 102.2 Fahrenheit. And at that point, you can stop the active cooling. You know, you can let them continue to passively cool at that point. But we talk about active cooling, what we're doing to get their temperature down quickly. Once you get them down to about 39 degrees centigrade or 102.2 degrees Fahrenheit, that's where we can stop the active cooling measures. So how do we want to get somebody's temperature down? Well, as quickly as possible. And I'll tell you, the best answer is immersion in ice water or the ice sheet. And I think a lot of people on this are familiar with the ice sheet, just putting a sheet over somebody on a stretcher and covering it with ice and just pouring ice water over them continuously until the temperature gets down, or dunking them, submersing them in ice water. Those are really the quickest methods that you can use to get somebody's temperature down. Now, of course, that can be an issue if you're in a hot environment without any ice or any ice water. But if you're, you know, if you're preparing or think you're going to have heat stroke for an event, then this is what you do. You have this stuff readily available. Now, also the advantage of the ice sheet is it's easier to use an ice sheet on somebody that's somewhat combative or confused than it is trying to immerse them in a tub of cold ice water.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Most of you listening right now are probably multitasking. Yep, while you're listening to me talk, you're probably also driving, cleaning, exercising, or maybe even grocery shopping. But if you're not in some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you can be doing right now. Getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy, and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Right.
So what do we do?
Just a quick question. So, you know, it sounds like a lot like waterboarding. So I'm assuming you don't put it over their face as well.
Yeah, no, you really don't need to put it over the face, because we've got so much skin surface that's available. So basically, from the neck down, you know, we don't need to be putting a covering over their mouth and pouring it over their head. Yeah, we know that you lose a lot of heat through radiation through the head, but we've got if we strip the clothes off and put a sheet over somebody and are just pouring ice water from the neck down, we've got a lot of surface area, particularly the core, the chest and the torso, where we cool them from, that we don't need to be specifically pouring it on their head and worrying about pouring it into their airway or waterboarding them. While we're doing it.
Okay. Now, is there any concern about, cooling them too rapidly? Is there some kind of a rebound response? And also, kind of similar to the hypothermia management of rewarming somebody, is it better to cool them from the inside versus the outside?
So great questions. And with heat injury, it's definitely different. So with hypothermia, you know, we're worried about the after drop cooling warming the periphery and then causing a shift of the cold potassium-rich fluid to the core and the heart. That's really not an issue with heat injury. Our job is just to cool them down as quickly as possible. So we're not worried about any kind of absent drop phenomenon. Now, the one thing you do hear about people saying is, well, we don't want to cool them down to the point where they now start shivering. And that was one of the original ideas behind the, you know, stop at around 102.2 or 39 degrees centigrade, is because, you know, you start getting them down too quickly below that, they're going to start to shiver. But it really turns out that shivering is probably not that much of an issue if we're using something like an ice sheet to cool them down, because we're still dumping heat from them so quickly with that. But the other thing is, if you haven't used one of these other techniques, then you're not down to that point and they start shivering for some reason, then you could use a benzodiazepine to take care of that shivering. But we used to always talk about where, you know, we don't want to start shivering. And it turns out that's probably not as much of an issue as we used to think it is. So if you see it, you can certainly give them some diazepam, IV, and that will actually control the shivering. But we don't really worry about them that bringing their temperature back up, because it's not going to bring it back up to that 104 range that we were worried about. But that's still why we said, yeah, you know, cool down to get to that 39 degrees centigrade, 102.2, and you're not going to have as much of an issue with that. But we also don't worry about afterdrop phenomenon with heat injury. We want to cool them down and cool them down quick.
So benzodiazepines, you think like 1 or 2 milligrams of percent, or like a very low dose? Is that all you would need?
That's all you should need. I mean, the standard's always been 5 milligrams of Valium IV to treat the shivering of it. But again, it's just really not as much an issue as we used to have. So, you know, you could just give a milligram of Versed if you need to, and see if that controls it. Now, if it's not, after a while, you could add another one. But again, I don't even worry about the shivering that much like we used to. Mm-hmm. Now, honestly, most of the situations we're going to be in, if we're not prepared ahead of time, we may not have ice available. So then what are the next techniques going to be? So the next best ones are then going to be misting or spray or pouring water on them with some sort of fanning technique, right? Because we're going to put the water on them so we can have that evaporate, because that causes a lot of loss of heat. And then we want to have as much, and that also causes some conductive heat loss, and then also convection with air moving over them. So if we can't use an ice sheet or ice water immersion, which is the best, right? If you have that, that's the best. And then the next is going to be misting or pouring water on them as cold as you have, and then some sort of convective cooling technique, be that fan or, you know, fanning with sheets, anything along those lines. Next after that is going to be, your chemical heat packs in the groin, in the axilla, on the neck, those areas. But that's even much less preferential to the convective and conductive by putting water on them and fanning it off. Then if you don't have that, then you're really in trouble. But you should be able to have one of those techniques in a hot. You should at least have a shady area where you can spray water on somebody, pour water on somebody, and then just grab a sheet or whatever else to continue to fan them until you can get your temperature down. Difference is going to take a lot longer with that technique than it is if you have an ice sheet that you can put on them, or an ice bath that you can put them into. And the military has actually had great success with our treatment of exertional heat stroke. I mean, actually, when we're prepared ahead of time and can ice sheet somebody, the mortality is almost zero. Whereas opposed to if you can't do that, you don't have anything available, then the mortality can be pretty high. So this is definitely going to go into your preparedness and your planning, particularly if you're going to be in an austere environment, is what can you have available and plan ahead of time to be able to do some conductive and convective heat loss if you can't have ice available where you're going to be.
Right. A lot of times I've seen, you know, when trying to cool somebody off, you know, obviously we're not carrying ice, kind of like the initial type treatment when you're on the field. And usually the tendency seems to be, we'll start throwing IVs in them and try and cool them off that way. Are you just making a bad situation worse, or?
So, great point on the IVs. So you know, if you get an IV there and somebody's got heat stroke, you can go ahead and put a liter of fluid in. So we really don't want to go more than 2 liters IV, though, at least initially, because almost all of these individuals are going to develop a SIRS response and can be predisposed to pulmonary edema. So I think putting a liter or maybe up to 2 liters into somebody, because we know they're going to be a little bit dehydrated to start with, it's going to be fine. But we really want to be careful after that second liter that we're then going into kind of a prolonged field care approach and matching input to urinary output. As far as the giving them a liter of fluid, cooling them down, that's not really doing anything directly to cool them down, to be honest with you. Really, that's just getting them to a euvolemic status so they can perfuse their skin and dump their heat. Really don't think of it as a way of cooling them down, giving them fluid. We're just giving them enough fluid to make sure that they have a normal volume status. So, yeah, glad you brought that up. And one thing we definitely don't want to do is just suddenly give them like 4 liters of fluid. Because their lungs are inflamed and they are predisposed to pulmonary edema, even in some healthy individuals, if you just start flooding them with fluid.
Has there ever been any kind of studies as far as how fast you can cool somebody, you know, how many degrees or hours?
Yeah, there's actually been a bunch done. Ice water immersion can drops you the fastest. It'll drop you about 0.35 degrees centigrade per minute. So about a third of a, you know, so about a half degree Fahrenheit per minute with ice water immersion is quickest. There's actually a study that shows all that. That's why that's the quickest of all of them. Cold water immersion is the next. The next down to about a quarter degree centigrade per minute. Trying to see what the ice sheet is here. So the fan and shading, you drop down about a tenth of a degree centigrade per minute, and ice packs, you're down to even a fifth of that. So there's actually been a bunch of studies done looking at the cooling rates you get out of all of these, and that's where the recommendation. So ice water immersion being the best, ice sheet being the next best, but ice sheet's actually honestly easier to deal with the patient. Because it's really hard to submerge in an ice tub, and it's hard to have an ice tub prepared and ready to go. Whereas with the ice sheet, if you have the ice there, you know, you just put the sheet on and you just start dumping it over them. And particularly if they're on a stretcher, just keep running off of them. So they keep having that loss.
Right.
So that's what the ice sheet ends up being the most expeditious for us typically, and easiest to take care of the patient, even though immersion in an ice water tub is the quickest.
Right. The keys are just, you know, paying attention to soldiers, paying attention to the people around you, and when they start kind of succumbing to the heat, you know, just be kind of Johnny on the spot with kind of cooling measures.
Yeah, exactly. And I think this is why it's really particularly important to start paying attention to when people are getting heat exhaustion. Because that's the trigger that people are heading in the direction that you take of the heat stroke. You know, if you get a bunch of people dropping out with heat exhaustion and you're not doing something to decrease that from happening, then you're pushing your way to heat stroke. Now there are some things we can do to decrease the risk of heat injuries. And obviously hydration, you know, we talked about that. We want to make sure people are adequately hydrated, you talked about the quickest and easiest way again is going to be the appearance of the urine. The other thing we can do is we can make sure people are acclimatized to the heat. As humans, we can't acclimatize or adjust to the heat. We can't do that to cold, but we can do it to the heat. And basically what happens when we acclimatize to the heat is our bodies start to sweat sooner. They actually decrease the amount of sweat in salt in the sweat, but we increase our sweating. So that's just that's no piece of folklore to just kill off right there, is that when you're acclimatized to the heat, you actually need more fluid than when you're unacclimatized. Mm-hmm. You know, so everybody saw Band of Brothers and Sobel's yelling at the people that and penalizing them, the ones that drank out of their canteen, because the idea was he's trying to acclimatize into the heat, not to need fluid. It actually turns out as you acclimatize to the heat, you actually need more fluid because you do sweat more quicker and with less salt in it. So if you hear anybody out there saying you need less water to your acclimatized to the heat, that's actually not true. And trying to restrict water to acclimatize to equal to the heat is going to increase your risk of heat injury, no doubt about it. Now, the way that we acclimatize the heat is you have somebody doing some sort of physical activity in a hot environment such that it leads to a brisk sweat. And you have them do this for 15 minutes on, 15 minutes off, at the start, and you work your way up to 1 to 2 hours a day of an exercise session that causes that brisk sweating. Now, the cool thing is you can actually acclimatize people to the heat in a cold environment before they get to a hot environment. So you could have somebody here in the Pacific Northwest working out in an area that's warm that causes them to have a brisk sweat in a hot environment, and that will start their acclimatization to the heat. There's been a number of times that I've done the Mojave Death Race, which is a race, a 500-mile race in the Mojave Desert, the middle of the summer, and we would actually train a heat acclimatize before we left, so when we got down there, we were used to it. I actually had one guy that would a stationary bike into a sauna and work out it there once a day, so that by the time he went down for the race, even though it was 55 degrees up here, he was training in a hot environment, did that for 10 days before going down, was actually already 60 or 70% heat acclimatized before going down there. No matter what environment you're in, if you put yourself in a hot environment and work out there such that you develop that brisk sweat for 1 to 2 hours a day, you will actually develop heat acclimatization. And it's making those changes in your sweating, and it's also causing our body to produce a number of proteins that protect the brain from heat injury and other parts of the body from heat injury. So you can get all of that before you go to a hot environment if you know you're going to be going that way. And that may mean the first day, you know, you're just going into a hot environment, a sauna, steam room. I actually just had a small room that faced south, so I closed it up. It would go up to, 90 degrees in there and get on a treadmill. You start off maybe just a brisk walk is all you need to be sweating profusely for that period of time, and then you work your way up to more and more exercise. But that, if you can acclimatize heat before you get there, that's really going to decrease your risk of the injury as well.
Right. Yes, to acclimatize that roughly 2 weeks.
So it's what we say is that for young, healthy individuals, 7 to 10 days. For those that have medical problems, the pediatrics and the geriatrics, we say 2 weeks.
Okay.
Just for the sake of ease, I would say a week and a half for most people. You know, you'll get about 60 or 70% heat acclimatized. If you do it for 2 weeks, a young, healthy individual, then at 2 weeks, they'll be about 80 to 90% heat acclimatized. And then, so, who needs, so if we're going through all this stuff, who needs to be evacuated after heat injury? So anybody that has heat stroke you need to work on getting them evacuated out, because by definition, if you've had a heat stroke, you have a systemic injury. Now, while we're waiting to get those people evacuated out, we're in that austere, prolonged field care environment. What are the other things that you need to think about? So again, the fluids, you know, we've got to be careful with the fluids. Like we talked about, we definitely want to maintain input to output. We don't want to flood them with fluids because of that risk of pulmonary edema. We do need to watch out for rhabdo. You know, if we've got young, healthy individuals getting exertional heat stroke, they are at some risk of rhabdo. So you're going to be, you know, checking their urine for blood, and certainly checking the appearance of the urine. If it looks like they're getting rhabdo, then you're going to need to think about treating them for rhabdo, like a crush injury. The issue here, of course, is we got to balance that a little bit out and make sure very careful that we're not giving pulmonary edema by giving them that increased amount of fluid at the same time. So you're going to be very judicious with your in and outs for that. And, you know, individuals have heat stroke. A lot of them are going to have bumps and liver enzymes and a bunch of other systemic issues that are going to come up about 24, 48, 72 hours after the heat stroke. So that's also why it's critical to try and get up to more definitive care if you can. And I think that covers it, unless there's specific questions.
No, I think that's mostly it. I mean, I think the big takeaways are, you know, recognizing it and reacting to it. React with cool, either cold water and fanning, or ice sheets if you have that stuff available. They don't necessarily need to jump into IVs, you know, by lat sending quasi cool water into their body.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I think the keys are, if somebody's hot and they're altered, it's heat stroke, and treat as if it's heat stroke. You know, don't worry about, is this just some heat exhaustion? They're a little bit confused. No, if they're hot and altered, treat them as a as if it's heat stroke. Now, obviously, you got to consider your differential. You know, so if somebody's in a hot environment and they're confused, but to take their core temperature, it's 102. Then you got to start thinking it's something else. You know, it's an infection or whoever else. We always got to have our differential. But if it's an heat injury and they're altered, it's heat stroke, you got to cool them down as quick as you can. Best answer is ice water immersion, ice sheets. Next after that is going to be convective and cover them with water. And then after that's kind of all your other minor stuff. And if they got heat stroke, then you got to try and get them to some definitive care after that.
Things like Tylenol are not going to fix this type of
No. There's no pharmacology that helps treat stroke. Tylenol doesn't work. Aspirin doesn't work. And in fact, you know, since we're talking about shocking their liver with the heat stroke, probably, you know, at least theoretically, don't want to be given any of those things. Dantrolene has been studied, and in heat stroke, it doesn't make any difference. So for our, you know, our CRNAs and ologists out there that use that for your latent hypothermia, dantrolene does not help in heat stroke. Don't need to give it. So there's actually been no pharmacologic therapy that's been found useful for heat stroke. The key is recognizing it and bringing their temperature down quickly. So the only other thing I should, you know, if people are looking for a good reference, look at the Wellness Medical Society practice guidelines for the prevention and treatment of heat-related illness. They focus a lot more on exertional heat stroke, which is what we're going to be seeing with our military. You know, again, the classic heat stroke is more your inner city geriatric medical problem type individual. We really want to be on top of recognizing and treating exertional heat stroke.
For today's podcast, be sure to go to our website, www.prolongfieldcare.org. Find us on Facebook, YouTube, Instagram. Subscribe and stay on the bleeding edge of combat medicine. This is Dennis for the PFC Podcast. out. Boy is waiting there for you.